Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm doing great.
Fine.
Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell everyone a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report, but for Hollywood. After you are done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals, including an essay from yours truly on why Guns Akimbo, in limited release now, is the perfect movie for our hate-filled internet moment, and a glimpse into a long-dead Brian De Palma adaptation that might have changed movie history forever. We are paying good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now, and we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access, either $2 per month or $20 for the whole year. That is less than most Patreon accounts, and you get so much more bang for your buck. So now on to the show. Up first in controversies and non-troversies, does the new Amazon original Hunters go too far? According to the Auschwitz Museum, it does. They were none too pleased that the Al Pacino-led series invents Holocaust atrocities, highlighting in particular a sequence in which a Nazi guard forces a chess player to play human chess with real victims. Each time a player comes off the board, he gets executed. This is not the first time some have questioned the propriety of using the Holocaust as fodder for genre fare. A friend of the show, John Podhoretz, for example, has critiqued the X-Men movies for using Auschwitz as the impetus for Magneto's rage. That said, and I understand both the Auschwitz Museum and John Podhoretz's points on this, but I do think that there is something else to consider here, which is that one of the aims of exploitation cinema, and Hunters is definitely an example of that, despite being on Amazon Prime in a TV show, not a movie, to amplify the absurdity of real-world horror in a way that drives home the truly horrific nature of such events. But Peter, are there some events that are just so mind-bendingly terrifying that they're better not off being examined in this way at all?
I don't think that in this case it's that much of a problem. Look, I understand why people might be upset by taking historical liberties with the Holocaust, because in fact there are people who take historical liberties with the, sort of what they say about happened in the Holocaust, and they're lying about it, and it's used as propaganda to suggest that it didn't happen, to minimize its impact, to do stuff like that.
So in fact, I get the
impulse to be very sensitive here. I think that like it's actually a reasonable impulse in this case, in maybe even more than others. At the same time, when I read this article and when I looked at some of the criticism, it reminded me an awful lot of an article I read a decade or so ago, when the last Indiana Jones, the one with the beef in it, came out. And there was, I forget which publication published a piece by an actual paleontologist, archaeologist, something, or like it was an archaeologist who was like, Indiana Jones doesn't represent what archaeology is really about. And you know what? That's true and really kind of beside the point, because the point is to make archaeologists look like action heroes and look like really interesting people who you would might want to watch a big adventure movie about. And the point of a show like Hunters is to make out that Nazis are really deeply evil people who, and then to enjoy the tracking down and murdering of them in an extra legal and extra judicial way.
I think that if it's worth backing up and talking a little bit about the relationship between fictionalizing the Holocaust and Holocaust denial, because I think the best argument against sort of creating fictionalized Nazi atrocities is that there are people who say that all Nazi atrocity reports are fiction, that the Holocaust is basically a lie that is perpetrated by Jews to consolidate our own power. And so the argument against this kind of thing is that if you make up sort of Holocaust atrocities, then people who deny the existence of the Holocaust at all can sort of use those to say, you know, yet another instance where people were saying that the Nazis did things they didn't actually do. And normally I am fairly skeptical of the idea that it's bad to fictionalize real events. I mean, that's what historical fiction does all the time. It's a completely legitimate genre. It's much more about mediating our, you know, sort of historical memory and our relationship to the past and how we think about these events and the access to figures that we wish we had. I mean, Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell trilogy is one of the the greatest works of fiction to be released in recent memory. And we can't know that anything she's saying about Thomas Cromwell is true. That said, I mean, I think because the Holocaust occupies this very particular space in history, not just because it was bad, but because people deny that it happened at all and cast it as a fiction, the relationship between historical memory and fiction and the Holocaust is somewhat more fraught than it is in other historical fiction. I'm not saying that Hunters is wrong to therefore make up fictional events, but I do think it is a riskier thing to do. And, you know, that risk-reward calculus is worth making if you want to think about whether or not the art in question is responsible. Art, by the way, has no obligation to be responsible.
Right.
But it's, I do think, given the existence of Holocaust denialism, historical fiction works differently in the Holocaust space. It's also worth saying that, like, there's basically nothing you could do that would be more baroque and sadistic than what the Nazis did to actual human beings. And it's also, I mean, I don't know if either of you have read Rise and Kill First, which is the history of the Israeli sort of preemptive assassinations program that grew out of, to a certain extent, extrajudicial attempts to get justice for Holocaust victims by kidnapping Nazis. But it's like, you don't necessarily have to do any fictionalizing to make that work sound like action movies, because it functionally is. And so the need for exaggeration in this space, it's, you know, it's hard to get more grotesque or more action hero-esque than Nazis and the Jews who survived to seek justice.
Yeah, I understand. Again, I'm sympathetic to this argument to a certain extent, in the sense that yes, there are bad actors out there who say that the Holocaust did not happen. I almost categorically reject the notion that this sort of thing gives aid and comfort to them, because in part it comes across as an excuse. It comes across as blaming artists for the moral and mental failings of others, in a way that I am deeply, deeply uncomfortable with. But also I think it alleviates some responsibility for the deniers themselves, as if to say, I understand why you would be confused about the Holocaust, because somebody has made something so over the top and ridiculous that is clearly fiction. I almost can't even put my head in that mind frame. You saw a similar argument when Django Unchained came out. Django [S2] Yeah. [S1] Unchained was criticized by Spike Lee as being a piece of exploitation cinema. You know, I think he had one of his he tweeted something along the lines of the My People's History is not a spaghetti western. It is an actual crime, and how dare you do this, Quentin Tarantino? And I feel kind of the same way here, like. I have a hard time seeing the downside to playing up the horrors of horrible people and horrifying people. I think it is okay. I think there are certain people who it is pretty okay to cartoonishly vilify, and among them are Nazi exterminators and slave owners. And I have a hard time working up any agita against that.
Part of what pulp does is provide opportunities for cathartic revenge.
Yep.
Quentin Tarantino has spent the last sort of the second half of his career building movies that are driven by that idea, by the idea of rewriting history to make it more satisfying in some sense, to make sure that the bad guys get what's coming to them. I don't feel like there's anything wrong with telling stories that are designed to say that, hey, Nazis were terrible, and part of what we're going to do, as you know, part of the pleasure of this story is going to be that that those terrible people are finally going to get what they deserve.
And but I think part of the question is, whose catharsis are you serving, right? I mean, I think that the horror of Nazi atrocities does belong particularly to Jews. It belongs to gay people who were targets of the regime. It belongs to people with disabilities. And so, I mean, I think I totally agree with you both about sort of the role of pulp. But, you know, who like whose catharsis gets prioritized in these conversations? Catharsis for whom, right? And if, I mean, I get the sort of generic catharsis, like everyone should own that the Nazis are bad. But I mean, I think it's worth looking at a little bit, like if the people who were most directly harmed in a set of incidents don't find that catharsis or want a different kind of catharsis, that's a totally legitimate thing to debate. It's not an argument not to make the movie. But it is, I mean, I do think there's a question about sort of whose and what interests that kind of catharsis is serving. That's all.
Well, I think that that question actually is one we should probably come back to in our next segment.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Okay. So what do we think here, guys? Is this a controversy or a non-troversy to use the Holocaust in the over-the-top ways it is used in Hunters to illuminate mankind's limitless capacity for horror?
I think it's a controversy.
I think it's a mild controversy in that it's the kind of subject that's like worth revisiting and worth debating.
I can see both sides of the argument here, but I do think it is a controversy because, again, the whole point of exploitation cinema is to push boundaries and force us to think about difficult situations in new ways and to allow society at large to exact some mental and intellectual revenge on the worst monsters in history. And again, I keep coming back to the idea that the Auschwitz Museum suggested that this is, you know, going to provide aid and comfort to Holocaust deniers. And I think Alyssa's argument is better than theirs, frankly. I think better worded and more, more to the point, but I still don't.
I agree with that.
Don't quite buy it. All right, our main attraction this week is The Invisible Man. And fair warning, I'm just going to throw this out there now. This is going to be a spoiler-heavy discussion. I have a lot of things I would like to talk about that happened at the end of this movie, which I think is actually deeply kind of interesting, but that does involve talking about the end. So if you want to skip ahead 20 minutes or so, please do that. This is your warning. This is yet another adaptation of the oft-adapted H.G. Wells novel of the same name. This one moved to the Me Too era. Elizabeth Moss's Cecilia is in a relationship with the titular Invisible Man, and it turns out that this Adrian fella is a bad dude. He's abusive, he's controlling, you name it, he does it. She is on the run from this optics genius. He's some sort of tech magnate living in San Francisco in an opulent oceanside manner. And she flees. She gets away from him. She starts living with one of her, I think, friends. I have a question about their relationship exactly. We can come back to that. But she's on the run from this guy. He, despite having seemingly committed suicide, seems to be messing with her in her new hideaway. Her friends and family do not believe her. They think she's just kind of nuts. They don't believe women. They think she's wrong. So, of course, she's right. There is, in fact, an invisible man who is hunting her. But there
spoiler.
Is some, there is
spoiler.
Some question.
Come on.
There is some. I already gave the spoiler warning. The spoiler warning has been delivered, people. But here's the question that I think the end of this film raises. As the film comes to a climax, Cecilia kills not her ex. She shoots the invisible man while he is still invisible, but it's not her ex. It's her ex's brother, a lawyer who, earlier in the film, admitted that he hated his brother, loathed the way that Adrian controlled his life, just as Cecilia loathed Adrian. Adrian himself is found tied up in a basement, held captive by the brother, supposedly. Cecilia doesn't believe this twist. She thinks... No, she knows. She knows, just like she knew through the rest of this movie, that Adrian was truly behind it all. So Cecilia kills Adrian in cold blood and absconds with his invisible man gear, setting up any sorts of opportunities for a sequel or a shared universe or whatever.
It's actually going to be part of the Hunters universe in which she just goes around in her invisible man suit, killing abusive boyfriends and husbands.
Yes, but here's where I think this is actually kind of interesting, and it's possible that I'm being a bit obtuse here. Please feel free to call me out if I am. But you have a movie that is couched in the Me Too era, right? That is about a woman who is being gaslit and who flees an abusive boyfriend and nobody believes her. And then she kills her tormentor. But it turns out not to be the guy she thought it was. So then she goes and kills this guy, this other guy anyway. And what we see here, what we literally see on the screen, is potentially the dangers of allowing vigilante justice to be exacted upon a potentially innocent man. A man who we only really see doing one bad thing very early in the movie. He punches through that window. They shouldn't be doing that. But everything else we see is just kind of she said, she said. We don't even really get his side of the story on any of this stuff, right? So, Alyssa, I presume this was also your takeaway, that The Invisible Man is about the promise and the peril of the Me Too movement.
So interestingly, I was the one who turned to Peter after our screening and said, do we think Adrian was telling the truth when he said that Tom set him up and imprisoned him and like Cecilia is a victim? And I think that's a possible reading of the movie. And so I was the one who brought it up. I want, you know, credit for that much skepticism. But Tom has no incentive to be doing any of this, right? Either he is a sociopath and was lying to Cecilia when he said that Adrian controlled him too. But he has no particular incentive other than that to be tormenting her, right? Like, he also sort of seems like a misogynist. He clearly kind of gets off on, forcing her to listen to Adrian's last words, to, you know, withdrawing money from her after, again, spoiler alert, the invisible man murders her sister and frames Cecilia for it. So I don't understand what Tom's sort of independent motivation for all of this would be. It's certainly not in the text of the movie. And so I tend to think that Cecilia is still correct, that Adrian was behind all of this and that she is never going to be free or safe as long as he's alive. And there are limits to what the justice system can do when the person who's tormenting you is invisible and wearing a camera suit that leaves no fingerprints. And so she is a vigilante, but she exacts vigilante justice because the justice system has failed her. That was my ultimate interpretation of the movie.
Peter?
I think that it's a plausible reading just in terms of what the text specifically gives us, that Adrian might not have actually committed the offenses throughout, might not have been the invisible man at any point. However, like Alyssa said, the movie really doesn't want us, it leaves that idea open to us, but I don't think it wants us to believe that. And I don't read the movie as saying that that's the case. The movie is about the fact that generating sympathy for the female protagonist to the point where we believe her, even though we have seen very little direct evidence of her. Was he husband or boyfriend man's?
I have questions
of this guy's crimes.
I have questions about every relationship in this movie, aside from the sister relationship, Cecilia and her sister. I didn't quite understand if they were married or engaged to be married, possibly. I don't know. Or what exactly Cecilia's relationship was with the cop who she comes to live with. If they were just friends, if he was like an ex of the sister, I didn't understand several things.
The implication I got, so I didn't. I was wondering if he was the sister's ex, but the implication was clearly that the sister had connected her with this cop who she knew, because first of all, the cop would make it safe, and second of all, it was a step removed to a a person and a location where she would not likely be found. And so that was part of it, was just that he was a person, a known good person in her life.
Who would be harder for Adrian to track.
Yeah, and so made
and
her...
And also he's a cop, so it provides like a disincentive for Adrian to come after her.
So made her unable, made it impossible for her to be found, which is a big part of this, is the question of where do you go to escape someone when your life is so thoroughly intertwined. It's not like it's sort of, the movie actually really does a good job of selling this thing that a lot of people sort of roll their eyes at, which is... In fact, it's hard to leave because if you have somebody who is a really horrific abuser, that person, where are you going to go? How do you de-link your life from his in a way where he can't come after you at some point? And of course, the movie said, then the horror, part of the horror of the film is that even though she does this in a way that
she
normally
does all the
would
right
be
things, right? She leaves. Foolproof. She leaves. She's careful to cover her tracks. She like is trying to rebuild her life and get a job, and it's just impossible.
Yeah. And so what I liked, I guess I really liked this movie. I think that it is as good as Upgrade, and in some ways even a little bit smarter. Maybe I prefer Upgrade just because I'm a little more of a science fiction guy. But what I liked about this movie was just how mean it was. This was a movie that, without being exploitative in this sort of like, let's just manipulate you, it's not super gory, although it is a bit at times. It's not just sort of about cheap manipulation. It is about being really, really cruel to its main character, but for a purpose. And it sort of takes, and it immediately grabs you and sort of makes an empathetic connection between you, the viewer, and the protagonist, puts you in her shoes and in her mindset, and then drags you through absolute hell. And it is just a cruel, vicious little movie that is incredibly well executed. And this is the other thing that I wanted to say, is this movie has like a very good kind of a conceptual idea, which is, let's take the Invisible Man story and let's make it about an abusive boyfriend or husband, and let's use it as a metaphor. But that idea alone is not good enough to sell a movie. And what Lee Whannell did here was actually figure out how to execute on that in ways that aren't necessarily obvious, in ways that totally support that premise, that are super smart and work really, really well, and actually just take it to some of the logical, very, very dark places, again, without just doing it just to sort of say, let's abuse this woman for the purposes of, enjoying her abuse. In fact, one of the things that I really like about this movie that's interesting is we don't get the sort of traditional full 30 minutes first act of abuse that we're supposed to pay off in the third act with, an act of satisfying revenge, right?
But
it starts
also,
with
that,
her leaving.
That also, that omission also kind of emphasizes the kind of thematic question I'm trolledily asking in whether or not we should believe her, because it is very much...
We should believe her, right? I mean, we see this guy chase her through the woods at night, punch out a car window, and try to choke her out through it, right? I mean...
No, I agree. I'm asking it very trollily. I agree. Yeah. I agree that she has perfectly good reason to leave him, obviously, just from that, bit.
And to fear for her life, right? Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, but someone who, like, you don't have to, like... Your ex doesn't have to be haunting you in an invisible man suit and cutting your sister's throat in the middle of a restaurant and framing you for it. If a guy will punch through a car window, try to drag you out through that broken out window by your throat, you have reason to be in fear of your life. Like, literally nothing else that happens in the movie could follow, and all of Cecilia's fear would be justified.
I think that's right. And the other thing the movie does is it doesn't dramatize the sort of long period of abuse that we are made to understand existed. Instead, it just has this one little bit where she gets asked about it, and she sort of suggests, well, he was violent to me,
among other things.
And so it just leaves the rest to your imagination. And here's what's happening in that scene is the whole movie is about how everybody thinks she's imagining something, but in fact, she's right. it's really happening. The crazy, impossible thing that she is imagining is, in fact, a real thing that is actually happening to her, because there is a person out there who is abusing her from his position as somebody that no one else can see, no one else even believes exists. And so the movie is saying she's right when she says all this stuff that, like, that there might not be obvious evidence for. So in some ways, it's a little bit – it's like a test of the audience. No. Are you actually going to commit to believing that this person is not crazy and is telling the truth? Which is what you should do based on the movie, or, you know, are you going to be Sonny Bunch and trollishly ask, maybe she's not, maybe we shouldn't believe this.
The other thing I would offer as textual evidence that Adrian has been doing this to her all along is the pregnancy, because the timeline is very much such that when she finds out she's pregnant, they say it's been a couple of weeks.
Isn't it actually... It's sometime in the last month, yeah. Right? Isn't it something like that?
No,
so it actually leaves a little bit of...
It's okay. So there's like a little... But it's like, it's early. No, I'm pretty sure the line was, it's early. It's just a couple of weeks.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, maybe that's...
We know that he theoretically kills himself 2 weeks after she leaves, right? Like, or she's in the house. She's afraid to leave 2 weeks later.
The time jump, it says we get a 2 weeks
later.
Title screen.
Yeah. So there are at least 2 weeks between... when he theoretically kills himself. And then my strong impression from the movie is that the following events take place over a period of time, right? It's not like all compressed in like 2 days or something.
It's at minimum several days, because we see several nights go by. We see her sleeping and then waking up. We see there's one sort of particularly long and drawn out evening.
Like, there's a Christmas holiday. Yeah. Like, there's, I mean, time clearly passes. And
it seemed to me to be about a week. Was that?
So it's at least a couple of. Yeah. It's like in between her leaving the house and like all of this happening. It's at least, let's say, 3 weeks, right? And so when she finds out she's pregnant, you know, Tom says that Adrian was sabotaging her birth control pills. But the movie also, in like the photos of her sleeping, in drugging her, implies a possible interpretation, which is that Adrian drugged her and raped her while she was asleep after she left. And the fact that, you know, there appears to be some actual investment in her keeping the baby suggests that it actually is his baby, whether it's from the sabotage birth control pills or him raping her after she leaves. And that sort of suggests a strong Adrian is behind all of this, right? If it's about like punishing her and then if the baby's not his, then there's no reason for, you know, sort of the third act to happen at all.
That complicates the final scene in which they meet at his house over the dinner table, and she says that if you want to keep the baby, then
if you want to be in this child's life.
Or something, right. If you want to be in this child's life, then you need to admit everything now. And this is what happens right before she goes and puts the invisible suit on and kills him in a way that makes it look like he committed suicide. The movie is designed to implicate the viewer in the question of whether or not we believe this woman with not zero evidence, but not a whole drawn out sequence in which he is obviously and clearly abusing her up front, and then, you know, sort of leaves open the possibility that it could be her brother, his brother, throughout the second act, that is, you know, that is stalking her.
And a way to flip the question around on you, Sonny, and like counter troll you a little bit is like the movie asks to a certain extent, okay, like what do you need to believe that she's being abused and it's really serious, right? It's like if a car window getting smashed in and her getting choked isn't enough for you, is him stalking her enough for you? Is him murdering her sister enough for you? Is it him, is him sabotaging her birth control enough for you, right? I mean, you can ask has she murdered an innocent man? At the same time, the movie can be saying, like, what is up with you morally? What does it take for you to believe? If you don't believe a woman's word, what do you believe? And sort of dramatizing that sort of lack of faith or that willing to grant a woman, that lack of willingness to grant a woman credence.
I think this is a totally good point, which is why the movie is actually more interesting than I thought it would be from the advertisements. Because the ads for this movie have been very blunt that the Invisible Man is real. I mean, like, it's a movie called The Invisible Man. It shows the Invisible Man, like, beating her up in certain scenes in the trailers and the ads and stuff. So it's like, okay, well, we know that this is real and it's not in her head. It's not, she's not, you know, making this up. It's actually happening. And I had kind of jokingly tweeted that the only way this movie would be interesting is if she was in fact making it up, that like there would, if there was some sort of twist that this was like all in her head and there is like actually a body somewhere that you could take her to and be like, no, he's definitely dead. This is all going, but I think the way they actually handle it is more interesting and more worthy of discussion. I before we move on, I do want to ask one question just about how cinematically how they actually build the tension in this film, because I think Winnell does a very interesting thing with the camera, which is essentially let it move almost like it's almost like it is on a roving tripod, you know, like one of those guns in Aliens, right? That like goes in the corridor and like looks this way and looks that way, looks this way, and he is.
You mean the turret guns that were cut out from the theatrical cut?
Yes,
and
right.
The only turret guns. Left in the director's cut.
It's literally the only version I've seen in the last 20 years. So. He does interesting things with the cameras to kind of let us look at empty space and see how empty it is. And I was really impressed by the, I don't even know what the term for this would be, just the kind of patience and calm with which he moves the camera. What did you guys take away from
that? So I totally loved it. And what it really reminded me was that he took all of the lessons from the Insidious and Conjuring films, which are these low budget, very high grossing, kind of cheap scare movies where there's a lot of this like camera moving through a haunted house and you see a wisp in the, the window and the shutter, you know, the drapes like kind of blow a little bit, right? And you're sort of like, what's there? The camera will then like whip around and then you'll hear on the soundtrack, there'll be like a cat jumping on a piano, right? Just sort of blonk, right? These Dolby jolts, this very cheap kind of, they're not scary. They're just designed to make you jump out of your chair. And Wannell actually directed, Insidious 3 and has worked with Blumhouse and that sort of world for a while. He wrote Saw, which we talked about last week. And it's like he watched those movies and figured out that what would actually be much scarier is if the camera turned to where you expect to see something
and there's nothing.
And nothing happened. And he just so, it's so smart the way he absolutely resists ever letting the drapes kind of move in, you know, with the wind and the way he resists all of these really cheap scares that you see in so many other movies and uses the lack of them to be actually terrifying.
Well, and I mean, another thing about the camera work is there are a lot of times when the camera is sort of watching Cecilia around a corner, like when she walks out of her bedroom and the camera sort of pulls back and then looks at her as if it's looking at as if you're looking at her over your shoulder and you're pressed back against the wall so she can't see you. It alternates between filming the movie from Cecilia's perspective and from the Invisible Man's perspective, which makes you complicit in terrorizing her, right? I mean, you're both experiencing it and you become the perspective that is haunting her. It's also just, as with Upgrade, a beautifully sound designed movie. I mean, it's a lot of sort of low tone, sort of ambient noise or silence used incredibly effectively to heighten tension. And I mean, he understands in a really profound way that this is a movie about knowing that there's something there and not seeing it. And so every void he gives you, whether it's sonic, whether it's visual, makes you crazy in the same way that Cecilia is feeling crazy, right? Like you're desperate for the explanation for the cat jumping on the piano, for the wind in the curtains that provides the explanation. And the movie just consistently refuses to provide it. It understands the terror of absence in a really profound way. And it's also, I mean, I just wanted to close out by coming back to something that Peter said about this being a vicious movie. It's also a really, really deeply empathetic one.
Yeah.
It goes pretty far towards making Elizabeth Moss look nuts and unpleasant and out of control. And yet it is, I think for most of the movie, just pretty strongly on her side and understands her perspective and understands her fear in just a really deep way. I mean, the moment where the camera just lingers on her face while the doctor out of the screen explains to her that she's pregnant, there's no dialogue there. There's no sort of necessary explanation. You just see this grief and revulsion in a really profound way and let that dominate. And one thing Peter and I were talking about after the screening is that, you know, the movie doesn't explain Adrian or Tom. It's not interested in getting to know them as people. Like, what is important about them and what overrides all other considerations other than genius, other than intrafamilial abuse, is just that they're both violent misogynists. And the movie is just really comfortable.
And sociopaths, right?
Yeah.
They're not, they're an extreme form of misogynist, which is that they both, it's pretty clear, have no ability to kind of to sense or care about other people.
But enough ability to read people's emotions to exploit them and torture them on the basis of that. And I mean, it's such a profoundly empathetic movie in a way that I thought it was a really good movie. As listeners of this podcast know, really don't like horror. And so I would not say I enjoyed the experience of watching this, but I am in a way profoundly grateful that it exists because it is an amazing sort of hour and 50 minute long example where if someone wants to know what it's like to live with misogyny, just go watch this movie, right? It's, you can't see it coming. You sometimes can't see it at all, but knowing that it's out there makes you live with this heightened level of tension in a way that's really interesting. And, you know, for all the talk about diversity and bringing new perspectives in Hollywood, the fact that the person who made this movie, is a white man is kind of an amazing thing and sort of lucky to have.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Invisible Man?
Thumbs up.
Big thumbs up.
All right. This week's assigned viewing is the 2016 action thriller, The Accountant. Peter, why are we watching this Ben Affleck, Gavin O'Connor pairing?
We are watching this Ben Affleck, Gavin O'Connor pairing to prepare for another one coming out next week called The Way Back. The Way Back features Ben Affleck once again with Gavin O'Connor. This time he's playing a basketball coach, a high school basketball coach who's recovering from alcohol abuse. In the case of The Accountant, it is about a special, we're meant to understand autistic accountant who also happens to be an incredibly competent and deadly hitman. He gets caught up in a web of corporate malfeasance involving accounting gags and eventually a lot of shooting. I don't think this is a bad movie, but it's not a particularly good one, and it's also one I really just didn't care for very much. There's a lot of financial accounting chicanery in this movie, and it sort of feels very, wants you to think it's very clever when it's explaining all of these complex financial moves, and it's just not nearly as clever as it thinks it is. There's a part by John Bernthal. I don't want to say too much about it for those who haven't seen the movie. He's sort of mostly kind of unnamed throughout the film. The twist that Bernthal is very good, but there's a twist in the end as to who his character is, and I just didn't find it all that interesting. The action scenes are probably the best part of the movie, but even there, they're just fine, serviceable, sort of pretty decent action scenes, and the whole thing is shot in a way that just doesn't have much visual style to it, you know, especially after watching Upgrade and The Invisible Man, which are these very low budget but incredibly stylish and really interesting looking films. I just found this kind of boring to look at. And finally, I also just didn't really care very much for Ben Affleck's autistic savant accountant hitman guy. The part doesn't really add up to a psychological profile that makes any sense to me. It's just a collection of tics.
Tortured by his special forces dad.
Right. Yes. And it just sort of seems like it sort of treats his autism like a superpower
a very special episode about autism and how people with autism can live full lives while sort of eliding like what life is actually like for some people who are, you know, have been diagnosed with incredibly profound autism. This is like a nonsense movie, and yet I find it perversely enjoyable, which I'm sort of embarrassed to confess. I think like the last sort of third of the movie, when it becomes psychobabble and action sequences, is complete garbage. But everything involving like Ben Affleck awkwardly hanging out and doing accounting with Anna Kendrick and talking about like the incongruity of dogs playing poker paintings, I just like, it works for me, man. Maybe I'm strange. Also, this is just...
So, but doesn't he seem too friendly and too emotionally available in those scenes? Yes, it's when he's talking about the thing that he's actually really interested in. But if you've ever seen people who are on the spectrum talk about the thing that they're super into, they're not talking about it in a way that is designed to connect and reach out with other people. They do it in a way that's like, they're suddenly you're seeing the spreadsheet that is their brain.
No, and well, I mean, I think it's also worth remembering, like, autism is a spectrum, and so people are at different points on it, and the movie doesn't, part of the movie's problem with it being, like, a very serious movie about autism is that it's just, like, it's not really clear where he is on the spectrum, and he's sort of in different places on the spectrum at different points when it's convenient for the movie.
I mean, a thing about autistic, sort of, people who are on the autism spectrum is that because they have difficulty relating emotionally to other people, they are often, they don't come across as warm. And so that's not a great thing for a movie star who wants to be liked. And so Ben Affleck does this thing where he sort of plays cold and cut off, and like he doesn't know how to behave socially throughout the movie. And then there's all these scenes in which he's like suddenly lights up and becomes warm. And it's like that's not the character. That doesn't make sense. You're doing that because you're Ben Affleck and you're a movie star and you just desperately want people to like you.
And Ben Affleck really, really, really wants to be liked. I mean, I don't think The Accountant is a good movie. I think like I'm a weirdo who resonates to various parts of it. Also, clearly this is my year of like just finding John Bernthal like really sort of compelling and hot. In between this and Ford versus Ferrari, I'm just like, why did I resist John Bernthal for so long? Clearly, I have been a fool.
It's a problem, though, in this movie because his character is underwritten, and yet he is so much more watchable and interesting than Ben Affleck.
Yes. No, it's, I mean, it's
here's
fine.
A tip for Ben Affleck. If you want people to really like you, don't star against John Bernthal because everybody's going to be like, actually, I want to hang out with John Bernthal.
His team of assassins.
I actually like this movie kind of a lot, and also hate it kind of a lot. But the reasons the reasons I hate it are like entirely due to the script and the structure of the thing, because there's this whole subplot that is utterly superfluous and makes actually no sense within the context of the film, involving J.K. Simmons as a Treasury agent who is trying to track down this accountant who is tipping him off to all of the bad guys in the world with all their money. And it serves as a distraction, but also like there's this long 10-minute stretch right before the final action beat that's just him talking. It's just him talking for like 10 minutes, and it's one of the worst written things I've ever seen done to like an otherwise pretty competent and like compelling
movie. It's 10 minutes of exposition that's like reenacted underneath the exposition.
Yeah.
The problem is the exposition doesn't tell you anything that you actually want to know.
Yeah, it doesn't tell you anything interesting about the main characters of the movie or anything about interesting about like what's actually happening. It's just this it's this weird compulsion to, and maybe this is part of Affleck wanting to be liked, that like Affleck can't just be an accountant. He has to be an accountant who is also undermining the world's criminal cartels. Like it's bizarre. It's totally bizarre. And I feel like there is a really solid 105-minute high concept action movie in this thing that is on the one hand disposable, but on the other hand like totally entertaining and charming, and has these great beats between Bernthal and Affleck and Affleck and Kendrick. And works on its own like relatively innocuous and unpresuming level. And I see that version of this movie, and I just get frustrated every time I see the actual movie, which I sit there and I'm just like, why is this happening now? Why am I being shown all of these things? I hate them.
It's
Sunny. I want to watch the Sunny cut of the Accountant.
I mean, the Sunny cut of The Accountant is like 90 minutes long, and there are like some weird gaps in it, but it's still 100 times better.
Yeah, it's just, it's a, just such a ludicrous movie. It's really bizarre.
There's too many things going on in it, right? I mean, yeah. This is one of the problems is it's not just that it's that you've got an autistic accountant who uncooks mob books.
Autistic accountant.
He's
one,
also a super assassin.
Two, three super assassin. Four, like
the financial crime stuff is just ridiculous.
Four, like psychobabble hootie hottie involving his special forces father. Five, yeah. Secretly undermining the FBI. Like, just what happened?
And this is kind of one of the reasons I like it is because there are so many ridiculous things going on in it. It's just like the ridiculous things that don't involve Ben Affleck, I find like deeply uninteresting. And I want them out of the movie. I want them in a different movie entirely. Like you could even keep the bit about being like the mob boss's favorite, you know, book cooker. But you just give that line of dialogue. You give one line of dialogue to like the computer voice lady, and then that's it. That's it. I don't know. Yeah.
I will say I did kind of like about this movie, or maybe not the actual movie, but the idea of the movie, is that it is a middle budget, star driven film without a lot of computer effects. And, you know, I'm happy when those get made.
Yeah
I just wish. Yeah. Maybe it's a be careful what you wish for a situation with.
Also true. I would much rather watch Ford v Ferrari than this. And they're both sort of in the same zone of, right, like October, November type releases that are not super effects heavy, but are kind of guy action movies that star like Matt Damon or Ben Affleck or whatever. They're all the same. And John Bernthal plays a supporting role.
I was saying boo. That's unfair. That's unfair to John Bernthal. That's unfair to Matt Damon. You know, Ben Affleck.
I just, what America needs is a movie where John Bernthal gets to wear a lot of really good period suits, as in Ford versus Ferrari, and murder people, as in The Accountant.
Would watch.
Next week's assigned viewing is Hard Target, which we will watch to prepare for the most controversial movie that no one has ever seen, The Hunt. That is it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com. And sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple. We need those reviews, people. If you didn't love today's show, complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch, and I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sonny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sonny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonnier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sonny Bunch, with music by James Malone.